Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supersonic Supertone Show. Barry Gray, the Thunderbirds' main theme. You sound like a chicken.
No, it's not. It's a trombone.
Sorry.
Or a tuba. You big banana.
Well, believe it or not, yes, I do have this on vinyl as well, because I've got a lot of 7-inch singles with Thunderbirds on them. The actual dialogue. You know? So I do actually have this on vinyl. I have cheated. I haven't actually got it out, but it's... we've got this.
It's amazing, you know, because when we said let's do the Thunderbirds main theme, I mean, because it's a beautiful piece of music and the anticipation and the tension and the call and response.
Yeah, I know. It's absolutely brilliant.
But what I didn't realise is he was actually born, Barry Gray was actually born John Livesey Eccles in Blackburn, of all places, in Lancashire.
There we are, not far from where I was born.
But guess what? How long ago? 1908, sunshine.
That's a no.
A long, long, long time ago. And he went to the Manchester Royal College of Music, and then he went down to London and he was working in Variety Theatre, and then he worked as an arranger and composer on Radio Normandie. And then after World War II, he went to work in the music industry, and he was working with people like Vera Lynn and this American guy, which I've just found out about. I knew his name, Hoagie Carmichael.
Yeah, very famous, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, when you look into it, it's like this chap wrote George on My Mind. He wrote this song called Stardust, which is one of the most recorded songs in the whole of the 20th century.
Wow.
1,500 recordings by different people.
No.
Yeah. From Willie Nelson, Bing Crosby, Glenn Miller, Nat King Cole. Loads of them. So, and also he worked in cinema and he did scores to the Thunderbird films as well. So the story is, I'm talking about this because I've done all the research. I'm really excited, by the way, because I love Thunderbirds. And so in 1956, this is when he really touched our lives, because he joined Gerry Anderson's AP Films and started scoring for his marionette puppet television series. The first one was The Adventures of Twizzle.
Which I can't remember.
No, I can't remember that. And then it was followed by Torchy the Battery Boy.
Nope.
And Four Feather Falls.
Yes, I remember Four Feather Falls.
Really?
Yeah, the first one. That's what I remember.
It was a puppet thing, Western, based on a concept suggested by Grey, actually, I believe.
That's right.
So this his association with Gerry Anderson lasted through the 60s, and he's obviously best known for the Thunderbirds scene that we've just played you. But he also worked on the themes to Fireball XL5.
Oh, yeah, my favourite. Oh, I used to be frightened of that. When Robbie the Robot used to come out, I used to go behind the sofa. It frightened me.
Is that where Robbie the Robot comes from?
Yeah, but it's not. I don't think it's Robbie the Robot. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But the most important thing about this guy, looking later on, he actually worked on Fahrenheit. Is it 451?
He did, yeah, but a different one. Or is that the one?
No, that's the one. That's
1966.
Yeah, that's the definitive one. What a great film. I didn't know that. But also, he had this. He worked with this device. Now, I can't pronounce it. We've just had a look on the internet. What's it called?
Right. It's called the Onde Martineau.
Well, it's like a an organ type thing, but you can actually adjust the pitch with like a pressure button on the left hand side. Now, bearing in mind, this was invented in 1926.
Yeah.
And as you waggle your finger on the keyboard, the whole keyboard moves, and it gives it vibrato.
Yeah, and you can pull this ribbon and it elongates the notes, and there's this little drawer that pulls out, and the pressure of the button is like using like a cellist would use as a bow or a violin player.
It's incredible.
But you see, that's the sound, because he also worked, you can hear that sound, right, on Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons.
Yeah. Wow, that's right. It's all that really weird stuff. Yeah. And you know, because I don't know how they did it.
Well, that's exactly. I mean, we've had this little bit of like, wow.
Because the theremin. I mean, of course, you know, we've got a theremin, and that's, you know, that's a very interesting sound. But this, and that was made very early. But this is a really weird thing, and it's like a cross between like a synthesizer. It's like an analog, the ultimate analog synth. Wow.
And he also did the theme tunes of Joe 90, and because he was such an expert with the Onde Martineau, it's named after a French cellist, Maurice, who he did the film, the music for Doctor Who and the Daleks in 1965, and Daleks Invasion Earth 2150 AD.
When I'm going down to Rosedale,
a crossroad, believe I'm sinking down.
Crossroads live.
An Eric Clapton, please. A vocal.
Woohoo! And that was from the third album by British rock band Cream, recorded at their first show on the 10th of March in 1968 at the Winterland Ballroom in San Francisco, California, and released in August 1968 as a two-disc vinyl LP. One disc was recorded in the studio and the other was recorded live, and it reached number 3 in the UK, went to top of the album charts in the USA, and was the world's first platinum-selling double album. And for that, you had to sell a million copies, Sunshine.
Blimey.
There you go. Cream.
Well, I like that version because it's not that extended, because, you know, later on they went on to monster amounts of, you know, soloing and improvisation and stuff, which, you know, I don't have a problem with. I do think Cream sort of overdid it towards the end, though, but because it wasn't like it was just basically jamming around the same chord, you know, whereas Zeppelin, they went off into different things, and a lot of other people, they broke into different songs and made it a bit more interesting. But there is absolutely no doubt that Eric Clapton, at this point, was at the height of his powers in Cream. I don't think he's at the height of his powers as a guitar player, because, as you well know, EC Was Here, I think, is my favourite record of his. I think that's his finest work in terms of his playing, his solos and everything. But, you know, this is marvellous. It's got massive amounts of enthusiasm. And one of the things about Eric Clapton, just from a sort of technical note, he doesn't just use the pentatonic blues scale. He uses a pentatonic, like, country scale. So he plays a lot more around in a major sort of way, which is very American. And a lot of the early British blues guitar players, with the exception of Peter Green, actually, just played around a pentatonic blues scale, which gives it a minor feeling. It can be a bit boring. But this, it has a lot more joy to it, if you know what I mean. And you can feel it, you can hear it. It's not as minor, it's not as dark sounding. It's definitely more, because playing a minor scale against a major chord, which is what you're doing in blues a lot of the time, it can have a bit of darkness to it, you know, and it adds a lot of tension. But this is quite joyous, if you know what I mean. And I'm sure now we're going to go on to talk about
the bass.
I just thought I'd get the guitar in first because it is Jack Bruce. Proceed.
Well, he's bonkers. Bonkers Bruce, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I played that track, and it's you start off and it's all guns out. It literally is just like you're just like this runaway train. Mm. But there's some beautiful moments in it. And I love the way you can hear him sort of accent with Ginger Baker, and then you hear him go and just have a couple of moments of Clapton, but then he just goes off and does his own thing. And it's like, for me, it's like loads of spaghetti all having a fight.
Mm.
Just it's like you know, watching Rhubarb and Custard, the animation, you know, if you never saw that, it just shakes and then it just scraps around and it's just, it's really quite high energy.
Well, when I listen to this, though, the bass, it sort of, it reminds me so much of Andy Fraser, because Andy Fraser, of course, he was, you know, growing up when Jack Bruce was doing this, because you forget that Andy Fraser, when he first did the Free Air album, he was only 16.
Yeah.
And so he'd only been playing a few years. And you can hear the influence in terms of the sound and the tone. But the great thing about Jack Bruce, what I think he really did, is because of the volume of the band, and he was using, like, big Marshalls for 4x12s, he was using that short scale, and, you know, I mean, You've got one, and that short scale, it sort of cuts through the mix. It sort of sits there, and even though it's a, you know, in a lower register, you know, in terms of octaves, it still comes through and it sits below the guitar, but weaves in and out. And as soon as you go up the neck, you know, above the seventh fret, you know, the volume increases and it pokes out, and that's when you get all that, you know, and it really drives the amp, and you get a great sound, you know, like you get this, because when you go above that seventh fret with the high one, the short scale, it just sings, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I'll tell you what I really like about Jack Bruce, though, it feels like there are two lead instruments there in that in that band, really, because they swap around a lot, don't they?
Yeah,
it's not just I mean, I'm as happiest as is like somebody, you know, you just give me a big bar of chocolate. For me to just sit on a simple groove and play a simple groove for a whole song, I love. And that to me is just bliss. And then there's the other side of, where I really like the challenge of getting your teeth into something like this and really going for it. So, I mean, he's what an inspirational guy, though. I mean, it's a shame I'll never get to meet him. But, I mean, his legacy is in his music.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's fantastic work.
But I think this, you know, because it's a standard, isn't it? It's a, yeah. You know. Did you know, talking about Crossroads, that Robert Plant, oh, there's Hummock shaking head, her ears are flapping around there. Robert Plant carried around his neck for years a bag with some of the dirt or the road that had been scraped from the Crossroads, where, you know, Johnson actually ripped this,
Robert
wrote
Johnson.
The song. Yeah, when he wrote this song.
No.
Yes, it's very true, yeah. And, of course, that's one fact interesting. But also, I was reading it in this book. In
that's
this
incredible.
Book. And also, Felix Pappalardi, who produced this, who was in, it's always tricky. Of course, he was in Mountain.
Yeah.
And he produced this, and he got he got a mobile truck to come out to record it. Because, as I said, but he was producing the album. And, I mean, he did a marvellous job of it.
Yeah,
because this is really early, you know, the late 60s. And people weren't doing this, they weren't playing as loud as this, they weren't creating as much of a racket as this.
No.
And for him to capture that live and in the studio is
a magician.
I think he would did for this sort of music and heavy rock, you know, what like Tom Dowd did for the early.
Well, he produced the studio side one
of
the studio album.
Of course, yeah. Because
it's in my notes, and I thought I did it in bold so you'd see it.
That's
right. Because
he
loved Tom Dowd.
Yeah, because he went upstairs. They had that that studio, Atlantic, upstairs,
yeah.
didn't
yeah.
they?
Yeah, yeah.
And is that tale about all the road he's walking up with all these 4x12s and they didn't know what to do and the volume was so fierce.
Well, because Tom Dowd actually was working on White Room, which is on side one. It's amazing.
Well, yeah.
I know.
Thank you.
Kraftwerk. Just wait for this noise. Beautiful. Computer Love from their 8th studio album, Computer World, released on 10th of May 1981. It was also released as a 7-inch single in the UK in July 1981, backed with The Model from the group's previous album, The Man Machine, which went to number 36 on the UK charts.
You do make me laugh.
Well, I do. Oh, I'm glad.
That was a bit of a mouthful, husband, wasn't it?
Yes, well, there we are. I'm supposed to make you laugh. I'm supposed to be your joy every day, every moment.
Yeah, that is so good, mein Herr.
Well, it looks like we're probably going to be spending a bit more time in Germany shortly.
Deutschland, yes, indeed. I'm practicing my German.
Yeah, it's all good.
And Dutch.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to going and visiting Kling Klang Studios, where they record it, which is Kraftwerk's private recording studio in Düsseldorf. Yeah, and we might even be able to hang out. I don't think they will, because I don't think they hang out with anybody. Florian Schneider and Ralf Hütter.
Yeah.
Who are the main driving forces behind the might of Kraftwerk.
Well, you know, I did look, and lots of people collaborated with them over, because this is their 8th album, and they've gone on and done so much work that it just gets a little bit dizzy for me to try and get my head around who was where at what point. So I was just trying to look at where they are now at this point with Computer Love. It was released in both German and English language, actually, which is really quite interesting. But what I like about these guys, they first met as classical music students at the Düsseldorf Conservatory. Classical music.
Well, you know, if you listen to it, though, it's actually, it's composed, this music.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not really improvised. It's actually a piece. It's a song. It's a piece of music which has, you know, distinct flavours in. And to them, the trombones are, you know, some sort of Moog going at the bottom and trumpets going ooh at the top. And, you know, and that lovely sound at the end. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but beautiful. I always wait for it at the end of this track every time I listen to it. But we've got a number of Kraftwerk albums, and our prize ones are that the Autobahn. It's like a double, it's a gatefold, isn't it? It's really, really thick vinyl, and it sounds great, you know. Anyway, but Kraftwerk, I mean, they're just amazing. I mean, they really transformed electronic music, you know, because a friend of mine and keyboard player who's in a band called Little Brother with a guy called Steve Dowd, he used to love Tangerine Dream. And we used to talk about it a lot, because Tangerine Dream were even more boring than Kraftwerk when you go and see them live, because they'd all sit down, right, and the only action you'd get is somebody had just like reach forward and then start to move a knob, and the synth would go, rather than going, it'd go, and then turn it down again, and that was it. So the whole performance, you know,
riveting visually.
But we've got, I think we've got 3 Tangerine Dream albums, haven't we? We've got Live in Vienna. There's a few ones, but we've got, anyway, another great band. But Kraftwerk really started it.
Well, they came from that same sort of German experimental music community, didn't they? In the late 60s, the same as Cannes, which is quite lovely. In this track, though, they used some of the sounds comes from a Texas Instruments language translator.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. That's the beauty of what they do. They listen. They listen with their ears, don't they? And whatever it is that makes a sound, they go, oh, yeah, that'll be great. That'll fit in there. We'll do this. This is great. So good.
I think, you know, when you listen to this, though, and you see they've got their own studio, and we had at our own studio, yeah, and we're going to reset that up now in Europe, and hopefully we'll have the money to have the time to be able to work on music, because you've got to sit down, haven't you, and really just sit there for a long time and start to think about stuff and ignore all the distractions and everything else and the internet, and which, because they really didn't have then, you know.
No,
because I know for a fact that when journalists wanted to get an interview from them, they had to ring them up at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And if they picked the phone up, and it had to be bang on, if they picked the phone up, you know, they'd do the interview. If they didn't, They didn't.
But I get that, though, because sometimes when the phone rings, it's like, I don't feel like I have to answer it. Not that we have a... I have mobiles, we don't have a landline now. But just talking about this whole bubble of creativity, though, as well. I mean, you need to get into that space mentally and emotionally, I think, with when you're creating music. And that's what I'm looking forward to when we reset the studio up, is having that time. Because as an artist, you need to grow. And in order to grow, you've got to saturate yourself in a space. And we've done a lot of living.
Mm.
And it's great now, I think, because we've written most of the, well, over half of the next album. But I love that little bit. Over the next couple of months, we'll be writing some more songs, which will complete the Language of Curiosity, our next album.
Yeah, but I think it's really important that you get up in the morning, you know, and this is what these guys did. They go to the studio and they just hang out and they're messing around with stuff. Like a text language translator, text instruments. You know what I mean? What a weird thing to... But they probably just dug it up somewhere. I thought, and you've got to have time to learn how to use it, to get it in and get some sort of sound going with it. And, you know, Brian Eno's a big one for this, in the fact he, you know, he's an experimenter all the time of this. And that's why I think he enriches the stuff that Daniel Lanois does, you know?
Did you know that there was talk about Brian Eno actually doing some collaboration with them, but it didn't happen?
Is that right?
Yeah, just I think it was the album before this, or the one or two before this.
It wouldn't surprise me, because it's got that sort of...
Same at Bowie as well, obviously. Yeah. But wow, Kraftwerk, sehr gut. Goat. I know. What do you love me for?
A bit of old goat.
That was a song called Run to Your Mama from their debut album World Music, which was released on the 20th of August in 2012 on Stranded Records in Sweden and Rocket Recordings in the UK.
Although currently based in Gothenburg, they claim to hail from Korpinolo Bolo.
That's right.
In Sweden, which according to the band's own publicity has a history of voodoo worship after a witch doctor came and lived there. Supposedly, when Christian crusaders came and destroyed the village, surviving people fled and placed a curse on the town. This has been described as a lovely story, if possibly not entirely rooted in reality. Goat. There's a lot of goat droppings involved in this band.
Well,
but
And they perform wearing masks and wearing they wear costumes as well. So there's this whole thing going down.
But they think it's this dark voodoo thing influence, you know. And I mean, there are a lot of Swedish fuzz monsters as well because they love fuzz. They have fuzz all the time. I mean, that great sounding guitar, that, you know, for a modern record, it's just got a lot of, you know, grunk and, you know, and really groovy. I mean, what did The Guardian say? They said it was
one of the best albums of that year.
Of 2012?
Yeah, yeah. I bought you this album.
You did? I wonder why I got...
Do you remember?
I do.
I did, yeah, because I was really inspired by it. I just thought, when you mentioned Goat to me, I'm like, this is crazy, wonderful, beautiful.
Well, you know, what I love about this, because, again, you know, I'm just bringing this Jimmy Page book, which I'm reading. I'm nearly finished it now. But when Page and Plant got together doing the thing together without John Paul Jones, they used a lot of Moroccan musicians and a lot of Arab-type sounds and grooves and stuff, which Robert Plant, of course, has been into for a long time. And that's one of the great things he's done. He loves Morocco. He's really pushed it. And that's what I love about these guys, is that what they've done, they've incorporated that real, you know, those very interesting grooves and rhythm instruments and instrumentation with some quite heavy sound, you know, and it's just chanting. I like the chanting as well, you know. But when you bought, that's right, you did bite me. That's what the no, no,
got you there.
I nearly convinced myself that I actually told you about Goat.
You did,
oh, did
you
I?
Told me about Goat. I remember. But what I love with about these guys as well, that they and girls, they listen to all music from all over the world. So for them, when they write, it's just for them, just it's music. It's not belonging to any different culture. For them, it is the culture of music because they've listened to everything.
Yeah.
So it all those, it's like growing up on a diet of spices from them. All the spices are at hand, and it's a natural thing for them to include in their music that they write. But they were saying they don't, nothing's really finished when they write music. They kind of just jam together and play together. And that's the songwriting process for them. It evolves out of them just actually playing together. So, Goat. You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Spooky Tooth, not Loose Tooth.
Spooky.
But spooky. Cotton Growing Man, the opening track from their sixth album, You Broke My Heart, So I Busted Your Jaw. Well, that's all good. Released in May 1973 on Island Records and recorded at Olympic, amongst others, Island and Apple Studios. But basically also Helios Consoles. Crunchy sound, just like the Helios. Great. I'm not sure whether the song's great.
No.
Because it's sort of, you know, we put it in because like Spooky Tooth, I mean, they're a very important band. And prior to this album, didn't the guitar player leave?
Oh, yeah. And he got replaced by, hang on, was it? I've got it in my notes now. So Mick Jones replaced the guitar player, cause, and then Mick later on went on to co-found the band Foreigner.
And this sounds very much like Foreigner, actually. You know, with those riffs and stuff and the breaks and stuff.
Yeah.
But the prior guitarist was...
Oh, I don't know.
Ariel Bender.
Hang on a minute. No, you're right. Hang on. The founding guitarist is Luther Grosvenor.
Yeah.
And he left to join Steeler's Wheel and later Mott the Hoople. And then, but he changed his name to Ariel Bender.
That's right, yeah. And All the Young Dudes. He did the solo in All the Young Dudes, didn't he? That beautiful...
Get out of here.
Yeah, produced by
Mick
Ronson.
Do you know what? I'm so bad sometimes at connecting people up.
Yeah, but it's so confusing. Because I tell you what has really confused me. This Best Recording Studios book, or British Recording Studios book, has confused me no end because that, it's filled with all these studios and they're all interacting. All these engineers and Derek Swetnam and all these guys were everywhere. And the founders of Trident and Helios and all these things. It's a mess. And all the musicians, of course, are weaving in and out of all these studios because they're like, one minute they're in IBC studio, next minute they're in Trident, next minute they're in Olympic.
It's cross-pollination,
yeah,
isn't it?
And that was the great thing, you know. And
busy bees.
Yeah. But, you know, great band to speak to. I mean, they weren't massive, but they're certainly worthy of note, I think.
Yeah, well, the lead singer, Mike Harrison, sadly, he died last year, and there was bassist Greg Ridley. He left to join Humble Pie, actually. But they were part of the early 70s British hard rock scene, and they started off as like a bluesy band called the VIPs, and then they had a prog rock group called Art. And I think the thing is with this band, and this is why, as you say, that we wanted to make sure that we had Spooky Tooth on the show, is that... Again, there's another situation where you've just got so many people coming in and out of the band. And also, by the time they got to this album, they had said that really they hadn't really got the material. Mm. That it was, this song sounds like 100 years out of date.
Yeah, because the actual lyric, the lyrical content is pretty
bad.
Poor, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But also, so they're basically saying it's a combination that the material wasn't good enough. And with a lot of personnel changes that they really... I mean, they've reformed later on because they split up, but... As you do, but I think it's really hard, isn't it, with the bands? You've got potential, but you've got to get on. You've got to keep your band together, and you've also got. It's all about the song at the end of the day.
Moving fast, everyone's last, ba-da-ba-do-da-da-da-da.
Triangle and Light Flight from the album Basket of Light. Released on...
Light Flight, Basket of Light.
I know. It was released on the 26th of October in 1969 on the Transatlantic record label in the UK and a reprise in the US. And the album went to number 5 in the UK album charts. Get in there.
Well, recorded at IBC and produced by Shel Talmy, who actually, he produced a lot of the early Kink stuff. And who?
Who?
Yeah. Wow. But yeah. That track is all about John Renbourn and Bert Jansch, who are probably the two greatest, or two of the greatest acoustic guitar players ever to live, or to come out of the UK anyway. And because we had Bert Jansch on the other week doing Black
Do you know
Black
they used to share a flat together?
No.
Yeah. Great. It's great. They were really good mates. Yeah, they used to live together. It's well, cool, hey? Can you imagine jamming late at night?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I bet they were trying to open tune each
exactly.
other. Well, listen to this bad boy, you know. This is a, you know, I've got all the strings tuned exactly the same note. Ha-ha! No, but marvellous. Great sound as well. And lovely, you know, moving time signature as well. You don't get that now. It's really beautiful, you know, that sort of drifty time signature thing. It was moving in and out of 5/8 and 7/8. I couldn't quite actually work it out. There was a lot of stuff going on in that. It was really cool, you know.
That song was a surprise hit for them as well because the BBC chose it to be the theme tune for their first ever drama series that was broadcast in colour. Called Take Three Girls.
No, I didn't
know
that.
Didn't go really, really high in the charts, but it was a success. It broke them basically, you know. So they were really excited about that. So, but what I find really interesting is the beginning and how did they all meet? So you got John Renbourn and Bert Jansch, who were flatmates and working together. Jackie McShee started off as an unpaid floor singer in a load of London folk clubs, but by 65 she was running a folk club at the Red Lion in Sutton.
Oh,
and then that's where she met John and Bert, and so she sang on Renbourn's Another Monday album. And then Danny Thompson, her double bass player. Yeah, and the drummer Terry Cox, they were known as jazz musicians and they played together in Alexis Corner's band. And what happened was that Bruce Dunnett, who's a Scottish entrepreneur, set up a Sunday nightclub for Bert and Renbourn at the Horseshoe Hotel in Tottenham Court Road because he wanted them to play on a more regular basis. And that's basically Jackie went along sort of singing, and a few months later you've got Danny Thompson, Terry Cox sort of billed as part of the band, and that's really how they became Pentangle, because they just played together they had a home.
You know, the interesting thing is about acoustic musicians then, I've just thought about this.
Yeah.
How did they keep up above the noise of a noisy, you know, a bar or a room? Because, you know, an acoustic instrument on its own is really quiet, you know, and a vocal.
I think the audiences have changed because I think in those days people listened.
And do you think, though, that because we've amplified it, people are now talking? If you didn't amplify it, they wouldn't.
Well, you know, whenever we play, if we go quieter, everybody goes quieter.
Yeah, they do. Anyway,
so it's interesting. If you want to, if you're doing an acoustic set and you play, if you really want to just get to back to a moment, especially as take it down and everything.
Yeah, they tend to,
Anyway, it's just, I don't know what to say except for I was just about to say something else then and I realised it's the end of the show.
No.
And we've got to go real quick.
I always say no every week because actually I'm enjoying myself so much. I've had a great one this week. You've been really enjoyed it. You know?
Really quite inspiring, actually. I've learned some new stuff this week.
Yeah, we have, yeah.
It was hurt my head. Yeah, exactly. I really love that instrument.
So anyway, thanks for joining us on the Supertone Show.
Woohoo! And we're going to play you out this... to finish this week's show with a band called Vanilla Fudge. Ah. Did I say Fudge or Fudge then?
I don't know, but it's featuring Carmen Apiece on drums anyway.
I love his name, by the way.
Yeah, great name.
So this song is cool. Well, it's in a few parts, actually. It's called Astra, Illusions of My Childhood, Part 1. You Keep Me Hanging On, and Illusions of My Childhood, Part 2. And this album got to number, their album, called Vanilla Fudge. It was their debut album. It peaked at number 6 on the Billboard album charts way back in September 1967. And if you like what you hear, they're touring again at the moment. So you can get yourself a bit of live Vanilla Fudge.
nothing I can do about it.